Happy Monday. I'm actually getting started a couple of minutes early, hoping that I can just get a thumbs up in the chat and we'll be ready to go at 7. I have looked at the questions that have come in really over the last hour. You guys get here early, which is great. And there's even a football game on tonight, which someone mentioned in the chat. I am recording it. I'm also recording the pregame show, so I won't miss that. I guess you could watch it and just replay the recording of this. But please give me a thumbs up if, like, everything is working. According to all of the colors and lights that flash up that you guys can't see, everything seems to be working. But you never know. I'm still waiting for a thumbs up. Huh. I get things like this. Oh, there it is. It's funny. It doesn't, maybe it's the glasses. Are they foggy? The thumbs up don't show up in my little sidebar thingy here, but when I click on them and show you the comment, the thumbs up appears. That's kind of spooky. Not really, but oh, there they come. Now all the thumbs up just came up. In fact, Quincy got a little carried away, but I appreciate it. 5 thumbs up. I like it. Okay. So I want to get to the topic, the short little topic that I prepare a topic every week. By the way, if you're new to this, this is just an hour and a half of Q&A. You guys ask me questions. I give you my thoughts. I'm not a financial advisor. I'm just a guy with a YouTube channel and some fancy equipment. But I have invested for a while. I have my own particular view of how investing should work. Not everyone agrees with me. That's okay. But I'm happy to give you my opinion on just about anything. In fact, feel free to ask questions that have nothing to do with money, like football. Chess is certainly a topic within my wheelhouse. So the question of the debt ceiling came up in an email. And so I thought I'd cover it. But as part of this, what I want to do is ask you guys a question. I'm going to start a poll. And the first question is, do you think our nation's debt is I'll call it a serious problem? I don't know. I'm sure I could word that better. But yes or no, it's real simple. Do you think our nation's debt is a serious problem? Let's give that a second. While you're voting, so as you know, there's a debt ceiling. I think the requirement of a debt ceiling, I looked all this up on the internet. I think it actually started like 100 years ago, the requirement that you had to have approval, to borrow a certain amount. But as you probably know, every now and again, we reach that debt ceiling. Now we've borrowed, let me just show you this. Here's what we've borrowed. This, let me make it a little bigger before I put it on screen. This is from treasury.gov. This is what we owe. Let's see, hundreds, thousands, millions, billions, trillions. Okay, just making sure. $31,380,309,986,690. That's what we owe. Now, there's other parts of the debt, and some of the debt is actually borrowed from other parts of the government, like the Social Security. It's not all held by, investors, let's say. But there it is, pretty big number. So that's the debt. And they tell us we're going to hit the debt ceiling in the third quarter of this year. And it's already become an issue. You may have noted that it took a number of votes for McCarthy to become Speaker of the House. The Republicans do have a majority, but it's a slim majority. And there are about 20 Republicans who they wanted some rules changed. As I understand it, and I'll confess, I didn't spend a lot of time looking at this issue, but they wanted some rules changed so that they could have a little more say on how things work within the House. And what a lot of folks believe is, look, it's sort of leading up to this debt ceiling fight that's coming. And so it's going to be an interesting summer going into the fall, because at some point we will hit this issue. And I think that, of course, led to the person's question. Now, let me go back to, there was a reason why I asked this. It's kind of I think it doesn't surprise me. I'm looking at the poll results. 82% of you said yes. Okay, that doesn't surprise me. 18% of you said no. Fair enough. Now, I want to ask a second related question. I'll say for those, I'm not going to type it in the question, but this is meant for those that answered yes. You think it's a serious problem. Do you only vote for politicians who are committed, I don't know, how far can I go, to, I'll say, reducing the debt. And I know that's kind of, you could word it a different way, but I think you get the idea. In other words, you think it's a serious issue. Is that driving your decision when you vote for a representative, when you vote for a senator? We'll leave the president out. It's a little different, I think, there. But like, you know, you may be a Democrat, you may be a Republican, you may be an independent. But in looking at a candidate, say, look, if you don't take, I think the debt is a serious issue. So if you're not willing to stand up and say, hold it, I'm going to bring everything to a halt until we can start making some progress on the debt. It's got to be part of what we do. That can mean raising taxes. It can mean cutting spending. It could be both. But do you vote the same way as your own personal views in terms of debt? This is a tough question to answer, I think. My sense is that while most people think the debt is a serious issue, we don't yet really vote that way. Part of that is legitimate. There are other issues. There are social issues that we care about. Maybe we vote based on the Supreme Court and getting certain, you know, either a liberal or conservative justice on the court. That's obviously an important issue. Maybe we vote based on a politician's view of defense of our country or the borders or assistance program. I mean, you know, the list goes on and on. Social Security, Medicare, the list goes on and on. And the reason I ask you these two questions, and it doesn't surprise me, we're looking so far, 70% of you that said, yes, it's a serious issue, don't really vote that way. Or maybe you have other issues that are take precedence. And the reason I ask those two questions is it seems to me that I think it's fair to look at our politicians and say, what a bunch of knuckleheads. But they're who we voted for. We're the knuckleheads that put them in office, I guess is what I'm saying. And until voters actually say, this is our number one issue, and we want to get it under control, and so we're going to put politicians out. By the way, that doesn't mean Republican and Democrat, because you know Democrats could say, as a gross generalization, Democrats are going to want to raise taxes to deal with it. As a gross simplification, Republicans are going to want to cut spending. Obviously, it's not that simple. And the only way to actually get them together to actually make progress is a lot of moderates, right? You're not going to get the far left and the far right to come together and agree on anything, as far as I can tell. And we're just not there yet. The only other thing, and this is how I think it'll actually get resolved, is a crisis. That's when we act. You know, we're not going to touch, you know, there's certain things we're just not going to do. It's politically would be suicide for a representative, a senator. And so it's not going to get done until we have no choice. And I don't know what's going to trigger that urgency. Certainly rising interest rates could. But yeah, 69% of you said, no, I don't really vote that way. So I did a little bit of research. It's kind of depressing, though. But you guys asked. Well, one person asked. Okay. So this was back in July. This is the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, sort of a nonpartisan in theory group. And this was interesting. So we're now, and I guess this is, for fiscal 22, interest payments are 400 trillion. It's got to be trillion or 400 billion, excuse me, 400 billion. Whew. But look at all the programs that it outpaces, including, by the way, it crushes what we spend on veterans. That's upsetting. So it crushes, it doubles what we spend on food and nutrition services. It more than doubles what we spend on Social Security, disability insurance. And if that has you a little upset, it only gets worse. So let me see here. I got to find it. All right. So this is the Peter G. Peterson Foundation. It could be conservative. I don't know if it's conservative or liberal, but this is just data. So here are the projections. Look at this. In 30 years, interest will take up 40% of all federal revenues by 2052. Interest will cost more than defense spending later this decade. That's stunning. Of course, defense spending has gone way down as compared to other programs. It used to be half our budget. It's not, you know, Medicare and Social Security are much bigger. Medicare interest payments will exceed Medicare 2046. Social Security, it'll exceed Social Security 2049. So I don't mean to depress everyone. In fact, you probably have all just signed off and said, I can't take it, Rob, I'm out. And I don't blame you. It's a serious problem. Now, I think in terms of the debt ceiling, you know, there are two sort of arguments here. The one is, look, raising the debt ceiling is necessary for us to pay for the obligations we've already committed to, and default on U.S. government debt would be horrible. So just raise the ceiling. Now, of course, if you take that argument, I suppose, another step, you might say, just get rid of the debt ceiling. Why do we even have it? If all we're going to do is rubber stamp every time we need more money, raise the debt ceiling, why even bother with it? So that's one argument. Another, but the flip side of that is, no, we've got to take a stand and we've got to make noise when we reach the debt ceiling, because when else are we going to do it? No one wants to talk about it any other time. We're not dealing with it. And at least when we start to fight over the debt ceiling, it brings it into the forefront of the public mind. And a lot of times, you know, for those that think we should cut spending or maybe raise taxes, you can get concessions by withholding a vote for increasing the debt ceiling. Now, here's what happens every time. It's already started. President Biden's already said it's got to be clean. I'm not going to concede anything. You got to just raise the debt ceiling. So the president always says that, by the way. It doesn't matter if they're a Democrat or a Republican. And if they're a Republican, the Democrats say, oh, no. That's not what we're going to do. In fact, Joe Biden, as a senator, voted repeatedly not to raise the debt ceiling. And if a Republican, that's a Republican office. If a Democrat's in office, we're going to see what happens. It's just the reverse. It's for different reasons. I think some parties could, and leaders could be better at sort of spinning it their way. But it's basically the same nonsense by both parties. And so it's going to be a circus. I personally think it should be a circus. I don't want us to default on the debt, though. I want us to, hopefully they avoid that. So what happens is, and you know, Janet Yellen or whoever's the treasurer, I guess she'll still be the secretary. There's some word that maybe she was going to step down, or I don't know. Anyway, maybe not. Maybe I made that up. What the treasury always do is, we've got to go into some sort of emergency maneuvers because we've hit the debt ceiling. So we've got to do all of this maneuvering. Think of that as sort of the warning track in baseball. It's like, you know, you're going out for that pop fly. You see the warning track and you haven't, doom hasn't occurred yet. You haven't smashed into the fence, but it's close. That's really what's happening. And then usually they raise the debt ceiling at the end of all of that. And it's interesting, like I see comments, like here's one. Good old Dave. Dave, how you doing? Welcome back. Congress has already spent the money. Come on. Yep, they have. That's true. That is true. I don't disagree with arguments on either side. I still think it's as crazy as it is. What other time do we talk about this issue? It'll come up in the presidential debate as it kind of honestly as an afterthought. Here's the reality. The debt ceiling presents an immediate issue right now that we got to deal with. The deficit and the debt, they don't really. In fact, and we don't even really know when it will present an issue. We know it's going to create havoc. We just don't know when. And it could be many years from now. And so it's easy to just let it go. I mean, trying to bring the deficit into some kind of control and ultimately tackling the debt is the kind of issue that get you voted out of office. I mean, it just will. So the politicians, by and large, they don't want to deal with it. Anyway. All right. So I had a few questions. Let me take that comment down. I had a few questions that I don't think I can show you on the screen, as is usually the case. So I'll have to put that up, take it off. Okay. Some good questions from folks that joined before we actually started the show. Let's see. Grant wants to know if I have thoughts or a personal preference on VB or VIOO. Expense ratio, number of holdings, small cap tilt. Thank you. At the moment, I don't. but let's figure it out. So we'll go to Morningstar, and I'll show you this in a second. I'm not as prepared. I didn't have Morningstar fired up and ready to go. We've looked at this in the past. So VB is a Vanguard small cap, right? And hang on. And so is VIOO. So we'll look at VB first. Well, let's compare expense ratios. The expense ratio is not going to affect it. This is 5 basis points. What's this one? It's 10. I don't know that I'd make the decision based on that. I mean, if all else came, was equal, I'd pick the cheaper one. What I like to see on a portfolio of a small cap. So like this is a small cap blend. That's what the blue dot means, meaning it's got a blend of value and growth. Now that's basically what I have. I don't have VB, but that's basically what I have. A Vanguard. In fact, I might actually have the mutual fund version of VB, now that I think about it. Let's see. What's the ticker? Yeah, I have the van. So I have this fund. It wouldn't be my first choice, oddly enough. I'm perfectly fine with it. It's in a taxable account with gains, so I'm not going to sell it. I ended up moving it from a Vanguard value small cap fund to this one for some tax loss harvesting about 4 or 5 years ago. I probably would have picked a different fund if I had to do all over again, but I'm not losing any sleep over it. This one, I think, is a blend as well, is it not? Well, it's kind of blend slash close to value. So I think there's this sense. So there's two issues here. This one is a smaller small cap. You can actually look at the numbers, by the way. If you go to market cap, so the average market cap on this is $2 billion. The average market cap on this one is going to be much higher. I mean, relatively speaking, 5.2. So there's one theory that might suggest, well, if small cap is good, and historically it's been pretty good, smaller cap is even better. I don't have an opinion on that. I can't easily put my hand on research studies, historical data that says that's actually true. So I just don't have an opinion on it. I do generally prefer value, small cap value, even though that's not what I'm in, full disclosure. So on that basis, between these two, I would probably prefer this one. Now, having said that, which one will actually outperform over your investing time horizon? I have no earthly idea. I mean, at the end of the day, they'd probably both be reasonable choices. Kevin says, I have $80,000 in deferred comp that will pay out over 10 years following retirement. I plan to retire this year. What is a good asset allocation for my deferred comp? Well, I don't have an answer to that, but I can tell you how I would think through it. I've never had deferred comp. So my understanding is, from what your question is, maybe I don't understand. So with deferred comp, I don't think you can control how it's invested at the moment. I may be wrong about that, but you're going to begin investing it as it's paid out to you beginning in June of 2023. That's my assumption. I could be wrong, as I often am. But to me, it comes down to the basics. So first of all, what are you going to use the money for? Are you going to invest it for a long period of time, short period of time? And what's your overall asset allocation now? So if it's a long term, think 10 years or longer, let's say, I would invest it based on whatever my overall asset allocation plan is. And then I would figure out if it's going into a taxable account, I'd want tax efficient investments for it. Could be a low cost stock index fund. But I don't know that I would invest it any differently than how I'm investing the rest of my money, unless for some reason I was treating that money differently and was going to spend it, say, in the near term. And I suspect, having said all of that, Kevin, I haven't really answered your question, but that's the best I can do. Vishnu wants to know, what are the pros and cons of dollar cost averaging versus lump sum bond investing? Well, I've done videos on lump sum investing versus dollar cost averaging. You can find those in the channel. I generally prefer lump sum. I'm trying to think though, would I feel differently about that with bonds? I don't think so. Because it's really the same issue. I mean, you can imagine interest rates going a couple of different ways this year. You know, some say the Fed's got, you know, the market thinks the Fed's got two more raises, then maybe it'll plateau for a while. Who knows? Maybe they will, you know, maybe the market, the inflation will surprise us and we see inflation really coming down quickly. And, you know, I'd be surprised if they lowered rates this year. I can't really see that happening, but I guess anything's possible. The point is, I think it's really difficult to predict where inflation and interest rates are going to go. In fact, we just saw it a year ago. You know, a lot of people thought inflation was transitory. There were good arguments for why it was transitory, and they turned out all to be wrong. And those were the professionals. Those are folks with degrees in economics. I've got an English degree. What do I know? Kevin also wants to know, this is back to the first Kevin about deferred comp. He says, if I withdraw from pre-tax, so that would be taxable income, a pre-tax retirement account, I expect to be just over the IRMA limits for Medicare. Now, there are multiple limits, but I'm assuming you've done the math and you've crossed one threshold, and it's a cliff. You go over by $1 and bam, you get hit for the year with extra Medicare premiums. Should I withdraw partially from a Roth, which would not be taxable, to stay under the IRMA income limits, or is that penny pinching? Well, no, I definitely don't think it's penny pinching. Why am I have a hard time saying it? Penny pinching. Penny pinching. Anyway, I definitely think it's worth considering. I don't know the numbers and what your tax liability would be and what the additional Medicare premiums would be, but I don't think it's penny pinching. Not at all. I would definitely evaluate it. And you might think about it in multiple year periods if you can, because you could end up having the same question present itself next year, and you've got the same sort of dilemma. And eventually, if you're taking out of Roth to avoid it, does that have any effects down the road for you? I don't know, but it's worth thinking about. But I definitely think you're asking the right question. Joshua wants to know about ETF investing bid-ask spreads. So like with a mutual fund, and I'll just give you an example here. Let's look at, we'll look at Vanguard just because, where's Morningstar? So here's the Vanguard total. This is a mutual fund. Their Vanguard total stock market index. Now, when you buy this, you're buying it directly from the mutual fund company. You're not buying it from another investor. There's no bid and ask. And you always buy it and always sell it at the net asset value, which is just the value of all the stocks it owns. And it might hold some cash, but, and here it is. Here's the NAV. I don't know if you can see it in the corner there on the left. And it's $94.49. So this does not vary throughout the trading day. What happens when the market closes is, I'm sure a lot of computers at Vanguard start crunching some numbers. They get all the updated stock prices or bond prices, not all the bonds in the bond portfolio are publicly traded, by the way, but they have other ways to value them. But in any event, this comes out, I want to say around 6, at least that's when I see it updated. And there it is, that's the NAV, right? So there is no bid ask, which is one of the reasons that it's one of the features of a mutual fund that I find preferable over ETFs. However, we can look at this same fund, but as an ETF, and you'll see right here, the bid ask. The bid, $193.60, the ask. So the bid would be like a buyer. Hey, I want to buy your share. I'll pay you $193.60. And someone selling it say, yeah, I want $194.06. Now, you're never going to get this. The bid and ask, I don't think, are ever the same. Maybe there could be. I don't think so. But with an ETF like this, you're likely to see it, I don't know, very, very small. here's the thing. When the market's closed, the spreads can get larger. And this is a fairly large spread, I think, for VTI. I'm guessing if you looked at this tomorrow morning after about 30 minutes, you know, when the market's been open, so like say 10 o'clock, I gotta believe this is gonna be a narrower spread. If we go to something like AVUV, and you may have mentioned this in your question. Yeah, look at this spread, 72 and 80, 81. Yeah, that's not really the spread. You're going to buy this at, say, 11 in the morning tomorrow, and the spread is going to be pennies. So if you don't believe me, set a reminder. Go back and look at AVUV tomorrow at 10:30 in the morning. But that's the bid-ask spread. So, you know, you're going to lose a penny or two off of most ETFs when you buy and sell. But, you know, the flip side, I suppose, is that this has, and I'm just using this one example. Oh, that's not the example I want. I'm not going to use that one. Let's go back to VTI. It's got an expense ratio of 3 basis points. And the mutual fund version is probably higher, 4 points. Yeah, so, you know, no spread there, but slightly higher expense ratio. Everything counts, so I don't want to dismiss it, but 1 basis point, I don't know. Okay. Here's a question. Any idea why VTSAX, which we were just looking at, is 4 basis points, as we just saw, but in a 529 plan, the same fund is 11. So sometimes in funds like that, you can see a higher expense ratio, which is probably designed to offset some of the expenses of the 529 account. Behind the scenes, how it works, I don't know if it's a separate share class. I don't know. But that's not surprising to me. I've seen that before. Sometimes you'll see it in retirement accounts. Joshua says, Rob, I hear that changing of asset allocation is a sin. Oh, now this is getting serious. Did you know I started to memorize the book of Acts when I was in high school? I'm not kidding. I didn't actually memorize the whole thing, but I memorized huge chunks of it. I still know a lot of it. The former treatise have I made, O Theophilus. I won't keep going. That's Acts, first part of Acts chapter 1. Anyway, I am accumulating and DCA monthly from my paycheck into index funds, and I buy allocate my funds consistent with my asset allocation. Why is it a sin if 1 month I put more money toward, say, one fund or another and deviate from the asset allocation? Well, I don't know that I would describe it as a sin. I guess my first question would be, why are you doing that? Now, some could say, well, I'm going to do it. In some cases, you do it to get back towards your plan. Maybe one fund has fallen off, so you put your contributions there. But from your question, it sounds like that's not the case. You're actually making contributions in such a way that will take you further away from your asset allocation plan. And I find that troubling, actually. And my question to you would be, why are you doing it? And what's the purpose of your asset allocation plan? If it's not to follow it, do you have rules on when you don't follow it? And it's not that I think this needs to be down to the penny. Like I've said in the past, I think, you know, asset allocation is a lot like horseshoes and hand grenades. You know, close enough is, you know, okay. But to actually intentionally move further away from your plan, even if it's a relatively small amount of money, the question I would have for you is why? And what's the point of having an asset allocation plan to begin with? Okay. Joe, and this is kind of, we were kind of alluding to this, with the debt and all of that. Social Security Board states that Social Security will be unable to pay or will be able to pay benefits in full and on time until 2034. And only about $780 of every 1,000 after that. Should we be concerned? Well, first of all, it's been saying that for as long as I can remember. I mean, the date changes, the numbers change, but Social Security has always been running out of money. And they've done things in the past to try to shore that up, but it pushes the date out. Whatever. But yeah, I think we should be concerned. I don't know. One approach from a planning perspective is not to count on Social Security. And if you get it, it's a bonus. At the same time, that's kind of an easy thing to say sitting behind this mic. You know, yeah, just don't count Social Security, where a lot of people really are relying on it. And if they don't count it, that can mean a number of years more working. Of course, others would say, well, yeah, but given the situation, I don't think for right now in the current political climate, and current, I don't mean this year or this administration, but this time period in our history, it's hard for me to believe that they're going to do anything to Social Security that would take benefits away from seniors, those collecting it, or those about to collect it. I just find that. I just think it's, you know, the third rail of politics. There's a number of third rails of politics. That's one of them. So I think it's very unlikely that that's going to happen. I could see, you know, one way this gets changed is a total restructuring of something like Medicare and Social Security in ways that effectively they can hide the impacts. I don't mean that quite as devious as that sounds, but hide it in a sense that, you know, it's complicated and you need to do what you need to do to get it passed. I mean, that was the Affordable Care Act. There were all kinds of hidden bombs, hidden things in the Affordable Care Act that helped some and hurt others. Some of them came out during, you know, the time when they were trying to pass that legislation, and some of it didn't. And I've long forgot many of the issues. I spent a fair amount of time looking at that at the time. But in any event, I'm not losing sleep over it, but I do think the day is going to come when we have to pay the piper. We can't just keep going into the debt we're going into. The interest payments get bigger and bigger. We just can't do that forever. Right now, what do we, you know, people talk about the low rates that we've had that help us. That's true. All of our debt is in U.S. dollars. That's a big help. You have inflationary debt cycles when you borrow in other currencies. Think the Asian currency crisis in the late 90s. And we're the reserve currency of the world. So we have that going for us. But that could change, right? This is just a feel good show, isn't it? Cody wants to know if I have thoughts on when it's optimal to take Social Security. No. It's too complicated. I can show you this tool from my friend Mike Piper. Open Social Security will help you do some calculations, but this is just the number side of it. Actually, I wonder if I don't know if he may do some consulting. I don't know, but you could contact him. I mean, when we get to that age, and I think I already know what we're going to do, but I'll probably consult with someone. It's just too complicated. And that's why people specialize in this thing. But that's one tool you could use. Maxify, which I've been promising a video on, does, I think, a pretty interesting job of coming up with the best claiming strategies. Yeah. Okay. Now I'm back to comments where I can actually put them up on the screen. By the way, is the poll, let's see what we did here. Did I end that last poll? I did. Okay. I'm going to do another poll here real quick, and then I'll start answering more questions. Will the S&P 500 be higher on 12/31/23 than it is today? Yes, no, I have no idea. Okay. So Paul asked, he said, I noticed your portfolio last week had about 7% in tips. What makes the tips more attractive in your view and for what investment goal? Well, it kind of has taken the Swenson approach. He's passed away, but he was the one that managed Yale's endowment. And he wrote a book, which I have somewhere. I think every time I think of this book, I say the same thing. He wrote a book and I turn around, I'm looking at my books. Yeah, I have no idea where it is. Could be upstairs. In any event, I learned the idea from him, and it was to basically split your bond portfolio between nominal bonds, and inflation-adjusted bonds. The theory being, we don't really know which one's going to prove to be better, right? If inflation is higher than the market expects, TIPS will pay off. They'll be the better deal. And if it's lower than the market expects, nominal bonds will be the better deal. And so it's just basically a split. I also have, it's not a perfect split in my portfolio because I have some money in T-bills. But that's my thinking, Paul. Yeah. I actually think I think I'm needing glasses more and more, although the screen is a little far away. Yeah, that's not going to work. Okay, maybe I need to pull the monitor closer. Let's see. So Fast Eddie wants to know, how's the chess going? Any tournaments? So I've been studying a fair amount. I'll show you. I'm probably going to lose all the viewers because who cares about chess, right? I use a program called Chessable to study chess. And it's pretty interesting, I think. So like this is a book. It's called the Woodpecker Method. It's just basically drilling the same positions over and over again. And this is sort of a lot of fun. Well, fun if you like chess. So I highly recommend this if you're chess players and you want to get better. We'll review one. So the idea is, so I've already seen this puzzle. So, and I know it's not very big. Let me see if I can make it bigger. No, I can't. How about that? There we go. Maybe I can. Oh, there it is. Huh? So the idea is, in theory, because I've seen this puzzle before, I should be able to solve it very quickly, right? And but you can play through this, and it'll keep track of the ones you miss and show them to you again more frequently. I'm not going to try to solve this puzzle while I'm doing the show. I have no idea. I am playing in the U.S. Amateur Team Event, which is in Parsippany, New Jersey, in February. Longtime viewers of the show know that I talk about that trip every year. I talk about how to turn left anywhere in New Jersey. You first have to go right. I don't get it. And you can't pump your own gas, which I find un-American. But they have good diners, and they have Parsippany. It's just a cool name of a town. It's fun to say. Okay. I am part of the DC Chess League, and I played a pretty good game the last time I played, about a month ago, and won. It was a king's, I was black. The player playing the white pieces played a king's gambit. E4, E5, F4. And I play a counter gambit against that. I play D5. Anyway, enough of that. Okay, so I'm definitely rooting for TCU. It's an underdog, so I'm gonna root for TCU. I can't root for a team that took out Marvin Harrison Jr. on a cheap shot. Can't do it. Sorry. What's the second question? I notice you don't own small cap value. Yeah, I think I've explained why. I like small cap value. So it was a tax loss harvesting thing. I don't know if AVUV existed back then. Would I have gone with AVUV? I don't know. I like AVUV. What? What kind of question is this, Conscience? Welcome back, by the way. Who is your favorite active trader and why is it Jim Cramer? Jim is interesting. He's a very smart guy, and I find him entertaining, and it's amazing how much he gets wrong. In fairness to Jim, the problem isn't that he's a smart guy. It's an entertainment show. He's going on and on about every public company in the world, practically. Of course he's going to get a lot of it just flat out wrong. I would, too, if I was forced to give an opinion about everything. The bigger question is, does anyone actually listen to the show for investing tips? I don't know. I don't. I don't actually watch them that often. Every now and again, it's fun to hit them. You hit the buzzer, you know. I watch it for like 30 seconds, and then I'm off to something else. Well, PH has an interesting question. I've been doing a lot of study on more on safe withdrawal rates, but the CAPE, do you have any thoughts on using the CAPE ratio to help determine a safe withdrawal percentage for new retirees? Well, I do think the CAPE ratio, which is a cyclically adjusted PE, I can show it to you for those that are wondering what this is. It's a Shiller came up with it. Here it is. They call it the Shiller PE, and it's currently at 28, so historically quite high, although it's been higher. And Kitsis did an article. I think this is answering your question. That looked at how at the relationship between the Shiller PE and safe withdrawal rates. And see if I can find it quickly. It was an older article. I thought it was an 08 article. I've got it somewhere. Maybe not. I've got to find this. Hang on. Bear with me. Hold, please. Here it is. Maybe this is it. Did my notes save me? It'd be great if my note-taking actually helped me find this thing. Maybe. Yeah, I did. Wow. Here we go. So this is from 2008. And you can see the safe withdrawal rate is here, and he's looking at lower and upper bounds of the PE. It's the Shiller PE. He calls it the PE 10. And the lower the PE range, the higher the safe withdrawal rate. Right? Does that make sense? I'll try to make this even a little bigger. And so, you just saw a second ago, we're at 28. Now, by the way, I think you could argue that this should be adjusted because, during the last 10 years, there have been significant changes to corporate tax policy that are not reflected, I don't believe, in the Shiller PE. So I think there's some arguments that this is lower than 28, but still it's pretty high. And I think by just about any measure, it would fall into this upper range. That still gives you a lower safe withdrawal rate of 4.4%. But he showed a high correlation. I forget if what it was around. Here it is. There it is. Negative 0.74. Negative because, right, the higher the PE, the lower the safe withdrawal rate. So inversely proportional. Hope this is making sense. But 0.74, it's a pretty strong correlation. Now, the one thing you have to bear in mind is that this is based on historical data, primarily US data. And I think there's been a lot of research on this, and Ben Felix put out a video. He talked about a research paper that came out in September, and I've actually had some email back and forth with the author, at least one author of that paper. I'm not a huge fan of that paper from a practical application perspective, but that's a whole nother topic. Or at least I have a number of questions about it. But I think the bigger question of should we assume that we've had a pretty good run as a country. Relatively low inflation. We've never had hyperinflation, at least not in the last, well, I don't know if ever, but certainly not in the last 150 years. Things have gone reasonably well. We've obviously overcome a lot of different things, but we've never been Germany post World War I, right? Or Japan post World War II. That's never been the United States. And so it's just something to keep in mind. But I'm getting off, I guess, topic. I think you can use the CAPE ratio as a way, which is just nothing more than saying stock valuations, as a way of thinking about what the safe withdrawal rate might be. Again, there's still no guarantees, but I see Ace Castle is watching. Hey man, how you doing? Let's see. I assume, by the way, I don't know why I assume this, but I assume your guys are rooting for TCU. You're not going to root for Georgia, are you? All right, we'll do a poll. Oh, there's a poll going on. Hang on, I forgot about it. Will the S&P be higher? 50% says yes. You guys are optimists. I would have voted, I have no idea. Although I guess if you're thinking statistically, your better guess is yes, right? If it's a coin toss. Who will win tonight's game? Now, there's Georgia. And I've bet on them. Georgia, you haven't bet on them. TCU, and I've bet on them. I'm sure I could have figured out a better way to actually word that, or just TCU. In other words, are you just voting, or like, do you have money on the line? By the way, I don't bet on sports. It's not like I'm against it kind of thing. It's just, I don't know. I don't find that kind of thing fun. I don't mind like craps or blackjack, you know, if I happen to be near a casino, but so Sean wants to know if high inflation, say 6 to 8% for 5 years would have a positive impact on the debt. I don't believe so. I mean, economic growth, right? You could imagine a scenario. It'd take a heck of a lot of growth for a long time, but we could grow our way out of the debt, particularly if we sort of put a lid on the spending. But high inflation is just going to raise interest rates. We're already paying significantly more interest right now because of the rates that have risen this year. So I mean, I'm not an economist, so I'm sure there are all kinds of effects of that I'm not thinking about, but I don't think high inflation would help us. Mike says, I definitely want the government to work on reducing spending, but threatening to block raising the debt ceiling is bad business. I hear you. Blackmail, I mean, I don't know. I don't know that I see it as blackmail. But I get your point. I get your point. Shutting down the government's a different issue, right? This isn't a shutting down the government issue. That would be if you're arguing over the appropriations bill. And that's a similar kind of thing, though, right? I mean, and I tell you, we feel it in Washington. I mean, it's a big, big deal here. Of course, it's a big deal everywhere. But, you know, there are times when people weren't going to work, you know, non-essential. Okay. And one person, my vote involves a lot of issues. Yeah, I'm with you. So does mine. Absolutely. That's the tricky thing. And here we go. We just keep kicking the can down the road. Matt wants to know, what are some major investing red flags? Well, it depends what you're investing in. Generally, like when I'm looking at mutual funds or ETFs, and I'm pretty much focused on index funds, but one big red flag is expensive. And those usually happen to be actively managed funds, although not always. They're very expensive index funds. But so costs would be one. If I'm in a taxable account, if there's a lot of turnover, they're buying and selling a lot of their assets within the fund, and that triggers capital gains tax. That's a big red flag for me. I have certain red flags about people that are managing. Like to me, Kathy Wood, just a lot of red flags. Michael Saylor, now he runs MicroStrategy, sort of a Bitcoin guy, lots of red flags. Anytime someone speaks with the utmost confidence about predicting the future, it's like, whoa, okay, I'm not going to hook my future to your train, your star, or whatever. No. That and they both do that. There's just no world in which Michael Saylor can even admit that Bitcoin doesn't work out. And, you know, it's just, where's the curiosity? Where's the humility? That to me, and I kind of feel that Kathy Wood fits into that a lot. By the way, both incredibly smart people. A lot, but a lot of smart people aren't great investors. All right. By the way, did you guys see, I see someone said they live in Massachusetts, so their options are limited. I assume that's in reference to politicians. I didn't follow the thread. Did you see that a politician, I think the youngest, I don't know, I guess the local, has to be, was elected in D.C. I forget his name, but he's the great, great, great grandson of Teddy Roosevelt. Okay. You know, I know the one thing about the debt ceiling is it's highly relevant to what we talk about on the show, but it's very, you know, politically. And so I am going to try to avoid like going down the rabbit hole of that. I don't know what the answer is exactly. You know, it's funny, they kind of had a solution where they would say they these bills wouldn't have an impact on the deficit. So the CBO scores them, but they only have to score it for 10 years. So, and I think I mentioned this in the article or the video about the changes to retirement accounts. They figure out weird ways around it so that, you know, it doesn't change anything in the first 10 years, but then we get clobbered in year 11. And it's like, I don't know. Doesn't seem like a good way to go. All right, what's the poll saying? Only 1% of you have bet on Georgia, and only 1% of you have bet on TCU. But Georgia is 70%. Yeah, that seems about right. I mean, they're certainly favored. I don't know about how many touchdowns. I hope it's a good game. That was the great thing about it, as much as I didn't like the outcome. Both of the games, you know, leading up to this one were a lot of fun. All right. What time is it? Is it 7:50? I got to get back to some questions. Carson says, if I own treasury bonds, bills, I presume I am one of the federal debt holders. Yes, that's right. The federal government has a contractual obligation to pay you interest. Well, yeah, treasury bill, it's a zero coupon, but pay you back the principal, you know, plus the interest effectively. Or if it's a bond, pay you interest, usually every 6 months, I think, and then return of your, you know, the face value of the bond when it matures. Yep. Yep, yep. You know, one question I toss around in my mind every now and again is, as you guys know, I'm not a big fan of like investing in gold, and I don't own any gold. Started to think, do I own any gold? I don't. Did I tell you I won 1 ounce of gold one time? But I sold it. But there's part of me that wonders, you know, is there a good argument for some amount of gold? Because it really is completely, I think, separate from all of the nonsense that our government's doing with money. But then I think, well, but for the gold that I would own to have a real meaningful impact in my life, wouldn't I have to have a pretty significant percentage of my portfolio in it? And I just can't do it. Okay. Dave, I don't really think they're thinking about a $1 trillion coin. I've read about that. I don't think it's a serious consideration. So Robert says, why not talk about the amount of consumer debt? Yeah, it's definitely gone up. And, you know, it actually went down. You know, of course, consumers were flooded with government money during COVID from a lot of different sources. And that's sort of kind of been gotten spent through the system. And yeah, it's gotten worse now, credit card debt. I'm not sure what to say about it, but it ain't good. So Rob wants to know, why BND in my portfolio? You mentioned intermediate treasury. Is VGIT a good alternative? Yeah, so there's and then he adds, go dogs. There's sort of two lines of thinking here, I think. So if we look at these two funds, we'll go to BND first, total bond market. This is just follows the Bloomberg Ag Bond Index, right? So there's other, you could get this in Fidelity, many places. But the thing to know about this fund is it holds three or maybe four, I guess primarily three types of bonds. 50% is in government bonds, so think treasuries, right? 26, or we'll call it a quarter of it, is in corporate bonds, and a quarter, roughly, are in securitized. I assume this is like mortgage-backed securities. Make sure you can see this. I'll take off the comment. Okay? So it's a well-diversified, and it's an intermediate term, and that's, you look at duration for that, 7 or 6.5 years. Now, let me pull up the other one he mentioned, which I think is just treasuries. Doesn't have corporate and asset-backed bonds. So let's see if, I'm pretty sure that's right, but let's double check. By the way, its duration is close. It's 5.2, so it's a little shorter. And yeah, it's all government bonds. So one argument is for this one would be, look, the bond portfolio, it's not the idea is not to get fancy. It's to be secure and offer some diversification from stocks, which generally works out just about every year. In some ways, it did work out last year. I mean, stocks were down more than bonds. I mean, it didn't work out like we normally expected to. And so we want the most secure thing we can get. And this, at least right now, in the 21st century, it's U.S. government bonds. There you go, and you're done. The argument for this is to say, well, yeah, but these are still really secure. The corporates are all investment grade. Most of it's AAA. You can see that here. But it doesn't get any lower than BBB. So it's all investment grade. These are, you know, some people, actually, this bothers them. The idea that it's backed by mortgages and you can get through, you can run through some really difficult times there. Honestly, I just don't have a strong opinion either way. I just don't. I think either one are perfectly fine. Is it wrong to say that? Should I have a strong opinion about everything? I just don't. I don't know. Well, this is a good question. I don't know how to pronounce your name. Kokoti? I don't know. Is that a word? Anyway. Do you know anyone that's actually successful selling options? I do not. I know a lot of people who tell me when the options they've traded did well. I don't hear from them when the options aren't doing well. And I know when they're not doing well because I know which direction they've bet. But no, and I'll go even beyond that. I don't know anyone, any options trader who actually knows if they've done well, that actually tracks, here's how much of money I've made on an after-tax basis, given my option strategy. And if instead I just invested in the underlying, you know, let's say they're buying and selling options on an index, if I just bought the index and held it, here's what I would have. I don't know anyone that actually calculates that. I'm sure they're out there, by the way, just because I don't know them. What do I know? I sit in my basement and talk to myself in front of a camera and hear from no one. For all I know, all these questions you guys are asking me are just ChatGPT, some AI system spitting out questions, making me think people are watching the show. Okay. I don't know where that came from. No idea. Noreen, thanks for, it went back up and now I can't get to it. But thank you for promoting the newsletter. All right. I send out a newsletter every Sunday morning. It's got like 10,000 subscribers now or close to it. Pretty excited about that. Every week I send it out, I get a flood of replies, which I'm thrilled, but I'm just getting overwhelmed. Even not responding, I still want to read each one, think about it. Sometimes it's a good topic for a show or the live Q&A. But that's a good problem to have. All right. Here we go. Bradley, watching tonight with my 11-year-old. Oh, that's fun. Wants to know your thoughts on investing with a 55-year time horizon and limited assets. First of all, the best thing you got going for you is a 55-year time horizon. The limited assets should not concern you at all. If you can start investing $5 a month, do it. It's going to be ginormous. I mean, we can actually look at some numbers. Let's see here. I'll pull up a little calculator. This is actually from my site, Savings Calculator. Hopefully it's not broken. So here it is from allcards.com. I built this. It's anyway. So let's say you can do, well, let's just do $5 a month. Of course, you know, for 55 years, I'll take the comment down so it doesn't get in the way. You're obviously going to contribute more as you get older, you get a job and so on. So we'll put the initial deposit at $5. Monthly contribution of five over 55 years. And let's assume, I'll assume 9%. What do you end up with? Look at that, $5. You end up with a total of 93 grand. This is $5 a month. Now, let's assume you can average, you can't do this now. You're going to start out slow, but let's do $5 for 10 years. What's that get us? Okay, we'll call it $1,000. So then you've got $1,000. And let's say now you can really ratchet it up and you can do $500 for the remaining 45 years. It's $3.7 million. Now, of course, you say, well, there's inflation. Yeah, but the monthly contribution is going to go up too over 45 years. So yeah, I mean, start now. Keep your expenses low and don't ever stop. There you go. And have fun watching the game tonight. What I like to do, so I have this note-taking app called Tana. Here it is, by the way. This is my view of it. This is, by the way, how I found Kitz's article so quickly. I have him in here as an author, and I have, it's already open. And I don't have all his articles in here that I want, but I have this set up so that any article I've put into this note-taking app written by Michael gets listed down here. Now, you can see I've only got two, but the one I needed, I thought I had it, was down here. Anyway, I like to look at this on my laptop while I'm watching football and just take notes of things that I think about. I'll give you an example. I forget what I was doing. If I showed you how lame I am, I was thinking about how we look at both market returns and inflation with safe withdrawal rates. And I was thinking, you know, a lot of folks are kind of talking about how Bingen used just U.S. market data. And they create these elaborate ways to look at other data from other countries. And I'm thinking, well, why not just do a global portfolio? It's easy to do now, right? You've got a Vanguard fund that's, one fund, pretty cheap. Get global exposure. Same thing with Avantis. So those funds don't have much history, but why not just recreate the returns of a global portfolio? And I would think it would be like a market cap weighted, by country, and figure out what the returns would be, and figure out what the safe withdrawal rate would be if you did that. And by the way, Wade Fowles kind of done that already. He puts it at about 3.5%. Fine. But I was thinking, you still have to figure out inflation. What inflation data are you going to use? Because, if you just use the U.S. inflation data, the reality is we've had it pretty good. I mean, we think 10% is high. Post-World War I in Germany, I think this was 1923. 18 to 24 was kind of a rough batch there. Their prices doubled every 4 days? That's serious inflation. So we haven't had that. And I started to think, well, what inflation data would you use if you wanted to kind of get outside the U.S. bubble? I don't have an answer to that, but I started thinking, it's kind of interesting. As investors, we can escape the U.S. if we want to very easily, right? There's international funds. We just talked, I mentioned the Vanguard and Avantis sort of global funds. We can escape the U.S. market returns if that's what we want to do, any number of ways. With funds that cost us a few basis points, it's kind of hard to escape inflation. I mean, because inflation is local. I mean, we could move to another country, but it's much harder to escape inflation or the, you know, now if inflation is relatively low, we don't want to escape it. We're right where we want to be. Now, what I'm going to do with that, I don't know, but it's in my notes. Okay. You guys were probably thinking that led up to something more interesting. Sorry. I find it fascinating, though. So much of the focus is on returns, market returns, as important as they are, but inflation, you know, when you look at a global thing and you look at countries that did really poorly, in fact, let me see if I can pull this one up quickly. I think I showed you this last week, but I'll bring it up real quick. Yeah, here it is. So this is Wade Fowle, and he's looking at safe withdrawal rates by country. I think this only goes to, yeah, only goes to 1986. So, but still, all these countries that got, you know, had a rough go of it, and that's putting it lightly, in World War I and or II, you know, and look at Germany here, look 1914, because remember, they're just on the, about to hit hyperinflation, the middle of World War I. Hyperinflation, you know, you don't need hyperinflation for long to absolutely obliterate the safe withdrawal rate. Hopefully we don't experience that. All right. Omar points out that the bid-ask spread on ETFs is kind of not all that important for buy and hold investors. I think that's true, particularly for the kind of ETFs we're buying, meaning there's a lot of liquidity, highly, you know, a lot of shares get traded every day. I mean, it might matter if you're buying some obscure ETF, but now, you know, it's interesting. Bogle, founder of Vanguard, much preferred mutual funds. And his point was that in times of market turmoil, if you need to get money out, ETFs can maybe create a little bit of an issue. I'm just saying what he said. He's a pretty smart guy. All right. Well, this is it. Omar also points out that in the book Just Keep Buying, which I have, I kind of started it. It's a really good book, I think, if you're getting into investing and managing your money, which I would classify my book, Retire Before Mom and Dad, in the same way. But he points out that he shows empirical evidence of that lump sum investing is better. And that's in part because the markets are usually up. What I have not been able to find, though, Omar, and I wonder if anyone else has, is any studies that show which is better when valuations are high. I've looked for that and can't find it. Here's a nice comment. I wish I came across your sound approach to investing in low-cost index funds before pouring so much into individual stocks. Yeah, I hear you. Although I do own some individual stocks, but most of it's in index funds. Yeah, so what economic scenario do you foresee taking place for the government to means test Social Security? I don't know how much of it's an economic scenario, as more as a political reality. It may be, I mean, the reality is that means testing Social Security will hurt those that are more, depending on how they do it, but those that are more well off, wherever they draw the line. And politically, that's probably more possible than just about anything else. Now, the other thing they can do is raise taxes, right? So there's a cutoff, obviously. What's the cutoff this year? 2023 Social Security tax limit. Yeah, here we go. Like 140,000? 160? Wow. 160,200. I can remember back in the day when it was much lower than that. And I was practicing law. I'm like, okay, when do I hit that number? When do I get more in my paycheck? I don't have to worry about it now. Okay. Noreen, I think, is being funny when she says it's an uplifting show. It's okay. Got to look at the reality. So Mike wants to know, he purchased an I-bond in April of 2022. I don't think you'll get a 1099, right? Because if you haven't sold it, you've not earned any. You can defer your taxes, right, until you cash it out. So if you've done that, I don't think I've never gotten a 1099, and I've owned I-bonds since, I want to say 2013. I've never sold one, so. Well, I don't know that I agree with this. We are not the only country in debt, so everyone is in the same boat. It's certainly true we're not the only country in debt. But and there are other countries that can be in worse situations, of course, particularly if they've borrowed in other currencies and so on. You know, they're not the reserve currency, so we have a lot of things going for us. But boy, our debt's pretty significant. But yeah, certainly not the only country in debt. That is true. So Krabby wants to know, I'm having difficulty understanding bond yields and whether a diversified bond fund will perform versus a savings account. So let's look at this. Let me first, let's look at savings accounts and then we'll compare. So we do a pretty good job of listing the best, I think. Right now we show the best savings account at 435. By the way, if you ever are on this site, and we track a lot. I mean, you look at the savings accounts we track, it's a lot. And we track recent changes as well. But in any event, if you ever are aware of a savings account that pays better, let me know. Or we track money market accounts. We have a lot of those and CDs. But so anyway, you can do better than 375, but that's still pretty good. Look at this. We got 455 overall CD accounts we're tracking, including broker CDs. And anyway, so if we compare that to like BND, it's a bond fund, it's got I tend to look at the SEC yield, which is the yield based on income that was paid out last month divided by the NAV, but and annualized. You can just click on that. It gives you the definition. And it's higher than the 12-month yield because interest rates have been going up over the last 12 months. But at any rate, it's at 414. So, you're going to do better on a bank CD at the moment, right? Or even a savings account. The tricky thing is that this yield is only part of the story. Let's say interest rates come down over the next year. Well, the value of this bond fund will go up. Of course, if interest rates continue to rise, the value could go down. What you generally know as a general rule is this. It's 414, right? Remember that. If you hold the fund for roughly 2 times its duration minus one. So what would that be in this case? 6.5 times 2 is 13, minus 1 is 12. If you hold this for 12 years, you're likely to have an annual return pretty close to its current yield, right? Even if bond prices, even as they fluctuate during that time. And there's actually a book that is behind me that talks about Inside the Yield Curve, talks about this. They actually put it in a range. It's not 2x the duration minus one, really. It could be a little different than that, but it's close enough. Which concerns back, I gotta wait 12 years? Well, it actually could do better depending on what interest rates do in the short term. But remember, when interest rates go up, bond values go down, that's a bad thing, but you begin to earn higher yields, which is a good thing, and those two things offset, and it takes time. Same thing if interest rates go down, it causes bond prices to go up, which is a good thing for the fund, but then you're earning less yield going forward. And so they kind of offset. But for a long-term investors, and that includes, I think, retirees, if you're 65 and you're planning for a 30 or 35-year retirement, and if you're not planning for that long, if you're thinking I'm going to use the money over the next 5 years, you should probably be in a shorter duration bond fund. I don't know if that answers your question. I think both can be a reasonable approach. You know, the thing about savings accounts is it can get a little tricky depending on how much you're trying to save because of FDIC insurance. And yes, there are ways to increase the limit and you could use brokered CDs. You're asking about a savings account. You could open up multiple savings accounts at different banks. You know, the management of that can get a little hairy depending on how much you're dealing with. Something to consider. Okay. Sergio, this is complicated. Your thoughts on a mitigating sequence risk by reducing stock exposure to, say, 35 stocks, 65 bonds, and then using a value average strategy to buy back into the market, so a rising equity glide path. Well, so sequence risk is the risk that, you know, say the first 10 to 15 years of your retirement, things don't go well with the stock market and inflation. It can really cause a lot of problems. That was really the point of Bingen's 94 paper. It wasn't the 4% rule. It was the importance of sequence of returns risk and inflation. You can, you know, there are some that argue for a rising equity glide path. Wade Fowle and Michael Kitsis did an article on that, so you could Google that and look at it. I think Michael Kitsis has said, yeah, well, you know, rising equity glide path, yeah, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Just depends on the market and a number of other factors. It can be a little difficult for retirees that are, say, you know, you start at 65 and you're starting to increase your equity exposure. Now you're 70, you're 75, you're 80, and you're at 50, 60, whatever, 70% stocks. I think it can be hard for a lot of folks to sort of stick with that. So there may be a sort of a practical thing there. The value averaging strategy, I've not seen any research on that in this context. I don't really know. Russ mentions that New Retirement has a good when to take Social Security calculator. Yep. Many of you are saying that inflation causes debts to become smaller, I guess, but it certainly would increase interest costs significantly. It would also increase the cost of what the government has to spend, right? It's going to raise salaries of all their, you know, of the military, of government employees, of all the things the government has to buy. It's going to raise what they have to pay out in Medicare as healthcare costs go up. It's going to raise what they pay in Social Security like it did this year. Big adjustment. I feel like I'm just a bearer of good news. I see there's Dick Cheney has made an appearance into the chat. I'm skipping through. I'm going to start skipping. We don't have that much time. I want to go all the way to the bottom, see what's going on. By the way, if you want me to respond to something, tag me or put my name in it. That helps me find it. Ah, here's a good question. Are you responding to messages to contact you? Like if you want to have a phone call with me? And no. I just don't have the time. I'm not a financial advisor. I don't have time. I do get them pretty regularly. If you're looking for an advisor, I have a list on my site of folks that you might consider. You want to vet them. It's not a recommendation on my behalf, my part. Let's see if I can find it real quick. Here it is. A list of low-cost financial advisors. I started to make it pretty. Look at this. Fit pictures and stuff. I got the first three on there, but then I ran out of steam. I got to do more. But I just don't have time to, you know, to have phone calls and stuff. Yeah, I wish I did, but I don't. By the way, I will encourage you guys. I know I get to so few of the questions, but if there are some of you that are like nervous to ask a question or you feel like you'll look foolish, please ask it. It's a good group. I don't, you know, Noreen does a good job of dealing with anyone that's a troublemaker, but I at least I think that's few and far between. And we're all learning, you know. A lot of becoming a confident investor is just learning the terminology and the concepts behind it. It's nothing fancy. I know of Josh Brown. Is the Compound, is he part of that? I don't know, but I don't watch that, no. What's the Compound? I like the name. Is Josh Brown part of it? It's a podcast. Huh. They look like they're having a lot of fun. They've got a cool studio too. That's what I need. Maybe I'll check them out. Chris, I've never seen this. I mean, with a mutual fund, you're selling back to the fund company. I've never seen them return underlying assets. Maybe it's happened, but I've never experienced that. What's the question? I'm kind of working backwards, so I didn't see the history here, Michael. I second your question for Rob. Risk assessment of SWVXX. I don't know what that is. Apparently not, neither does Morningstar. I don't know. No idea. It's Schwab Value Advantage Money Fund. 34 basis point expense ratio. What's its yield? Did I see 4.7? 4.27. So that's not bad. What its risk is? I mean, it's got to be, it's a money fund. So it's got to be pretty, it's got to have a duration of probably less than a month. But maybe not. Here, I'll show you what I'm looking at. Yeah, no, welcome to my world. I think it just got smaller. It is all short-term paper. I have no idea what the risk is of that, though. No clue. Feels good to say, I don't know. I just keep moving on. I don't know. I never get this. So this is LG. Real inflation at least 50% greater than US CPI numbers. I've never heard anything quite that extreme, but I regularly hear that the real inflation is much, much higher. I don't know what that's based on. I mean, certainly your increased costs, say, now versus a year ago, will certainly be different than the CPI number because of, you know, it could vary based on where you live, how you spend your money, do you own, do you rent? But 50%? I don't know. Russ says, I guess that derivatives book is not a page turner. It hasn't moved locations on the shelf in weeks. That would be correct. All right. So this looked like the start of a good question. I'm currently making 100 and we'll call it 20 a year. It goes up yearly. I'm in my mid-30s. I'm likely to max out a Roth 401k from now on soon. I couldn't do a Roth IRA. Let's see if I can find the rest of your question. I don't see it. Oh. I bet it was a good one though. Sorry. I'll keep an eye out for it. Try $100 a month. I think that's back to the savings calculator, right? We can do that. So we'll start with $100. $100 monthly contribution. I think we were doing 55 years, which is, you know, I guess if you're young, it's 1.8 million. It's amazing. You know, the mind just doesn't really understand compounding. At least that's my view. Mine certainly doesn't. When I was writing my book, I would constantly have to triple check the numbers because I couldn't believe that it would be that big. That's the thing. You know, when you talk to someone who's like out of school, out of high school, out of college, and you say, you know, they're making whatever, 30 grand a year, 50 grand a year, whatever the number is, and 25 grand a year. And you say to them, you know, can you be a millionaire by the time you retire? It's like, oh, and there's no way, right? And the reason is because they're comparing, say, 25,000 or 30,000 a year to $1 million. And when you compare those two numbers, yeah, it seems impossible. But when you realize, let's say you work for 45 years, we were looking at 55, you know, you need about 175. Would 175 a month get you there? Yeah, it would get you more than there. How about 150? Even 150 would put you over $1 million after 45 years. So if you think about it in those terms, if you say, well, can you save 150? Even if at that moment they can't, let's say, because they've got some school loans or whatever, they're not going to tell you, though, that that's crazy, right? I mean, 30,000 compared to a million, that seems crazy. Save 150? Okay, well, I can at least see my way to that. And that's really how we have to look at it. Now, I mean, everyone's situation is different. Maybe you can save more. Maybe you can't save right now, but you can start in a year, whatever. But Jordan says, appreciate your newsletter. I actually purchased a physical security token because your email mentioned it. So did I. There it is. I haven't taken it out of the package yet. I actually got two of them. He asked about SWVXX, which I already talked about. Oh, but he has some risk associated with it versus SNSXX. I just don't know. I don't know. All right, we got 4 minutes left. I'm scrolling to the bottom. What do we got? So Karen wants to know where to go. Are treasury bonds a good buy right now? Well, I think they're a decent buy. I mean, you know, it depends what duration you're talking about. But if we look at the treasury yields on the 2 year, it's about 4.25%. Is that right? See if I can find a better source. Like maybe, what's the 10 year right now? It's probably lower. Here's the 10 year, 3.55%. A lot of folks think that interest rates are going to start, you know, longer term are going to come down as the Fed tackles inflation. I don't have an answer to that. They're certainly a better buy than they were a year ago, that's for sure. But again, I think it depends on your overall plan, how long you're going to hold the money. I generally like intermediate term bonds. It's just what I've always used for long-term investing. But I haven't changed my asset allocation, so I'm not like buying bonds. And if I have money to invest, I'm keeping my same asset allocation. But so in that sense, I might, but not in big quantities. I don't know that I really answered that question. Here's an interesting question from Ethan. Advice on how to get over myself to quit my job and start a business. Well, it depends on what kind of business you want to start, what the capital requirements are for that business, how long you can live without income. I would very much look at it in as much as you can an unemotional way, which is hard to do because at least for me, it would be you're excited about a business opportunity, maybe, and you like the idea of being your own boss and so forth. What I did was started a business. Well, I didn't realize I was starting a business. I just started a blog for fun, but it became a business. And to me, it's the best kind of business in the world because it required almost no investment at all. You know, $10 for a domain and WordPress is free and it's your time. You can do the same thing with the YouTube channel. There's YouTube, I mean, I've got a little bit of equipment that I've bought. You wouldn't have to do that, but even that's pretty minor, all things considered. You can start a YouTube channel as a business and you can do it while you're still working. So to me, it was like the perfect combination. But some people want to open a restaurant or they want to start a consulting business or they're a lawyer and they want to open up their own practice. And I get that. And those things are more risky. So if I were having a conversation with you, I'd want to know what kind of business. Can you start it while you still have your job? What's it going to cost to start this business? Are you going to have to borrow money? How long can you live without income? Those would be questions. All right, gang, it's 8:30 and the football game. First of all, thank you for no one telling me the score because I'm going to end this live stream and I'm going to go with my note app open on my laptop and go watch the football game. And I hope you guys have a great week. Lord willing and the creek don't rise. I will be back next Monday. I will warn you, by the way, I will not be doing a live stream. I can tell you in advance. There's no live stream on January 30th, 3 weeks from now. But should be back next Monday, same time. So have a great week. If you haven't signed up for the newsletter, please do. I have a lot of fun putting it together, and I think people enjoy it. Anyway, have a great week. Until next time, remember, the best thing money can buy is financial freedom. Noreen, thank you for all your help tonight.